So it enters a different phase, even if it's not a true thermodynamic phase, where it's much more viscous. And eventually, at a certain value that we call Tg, which is not very well defined, the system falls out of equilibrium, and one cannot follow it any longer with equilibrium measurements. What I mean by this is that the time for relaxation goes beyond the times that can be reached in an experiment, and one can simply cannot see the system equilibrating, the sample equilibrating with its environment. Now, all this happens with no clear change in structure. If I look, I do a snapshot, take a snapshot of the sample at a high temperature, I see that the particles are disordered. If I take a snapshot at lower temperature, I see that they're also disordered, and they don't realize, I mean, I cannot distinguish any particular change in the structure of the system. Now, this plot here is a sketch. Now, what's going to happen with the viscosity if I would be able to do measurements below Tg, nobody knows. But some people like to extrapolate this curve below Tg and try to see if it diverges at a finite temperature or not. So there you can discuss if this has a meaning or not, but the point is that in some cases, for certain samples and for certain materials, this curve seems to diverge at a temperature that I'm going to call T0. Now, this could be associated to a static transition, perhaps, I don't know. Does this finite temperature T0 really exist? Is an open question, and I'm not going to say much about it. So, what's going on with the dynamics of these systems? I'm saying that nothing special is going on with the structure of the system. With the dynamics, when one approaches this region around Tg, one sees that, well, the characteristic time is increasing a lot, so the system is undergoing slow dynamics at any of these temperatures. And below, this happens, I insist, above Tg already. Now, around this value of Tg, what happens is that the system falls out of equilibrium, and if I want to describe its evolution in time, that it goes on, the evolution goes on in time, but it's of a non-equilibrium kind. So what one of the things we would like to do is to describe the slow dynamics starting here and the non-equilibrium dynamics starting somewhere around Tg. So I'm using here the example of a system of particles in interactions. This because it makes the connection with what one is used to, liquid glass transition, is easy. But there are other type of glasses of very different kinds. And one kind that is also quite well known is the kind of spins that interact via quench random coupling. So this is the case of spin glasses, which are a different kind of glasses. This is one of the questions we would like to discuss. What happens with the glassy phenomenon and why there is such a dramatic slowing down going on at around some Tg, and what happens below this Tg. But the other, so I insisted on the fact that the relaxation below Tg happens out of equilibrium. There are other systems that also undergo non-equilibrium dynamics, and there are several examples. One case that is calling the attention of many people now is the case of weak-tapped granular matter. So you have also sort of grains that I pile up in some container, and you tap this container to see how the density increases, or the level, the height of this decreases with time. Temperature is irrelevant in this case, but you are moving the system with the tapping. You're making it relax or evolve due to the external tapping. So this is a driven system by the external force. And there is also interesting dynamics of some kind of sharing some features with the glassy behavior that have been observed in the sort of systems. Another problem is the case of rheology of complex liquids. So you heard this morning about a system of Lennard-Jones binary system of Lennard-Jones particles that was sheared. Okay, so you can also do this sort of experiments, and by the shear, you are perturbing your system externally. Temperature does play a role in these kind of systems, but there is an interplay, a competition between temperature and the driving force that happens. So these two cases I'm showing you are cases of driven systems. There are external forces that keep the systems out of equilibrium. Another case that might be of interest for some of the people in the audience is what happens if I introduce quantum fluctuations. So in the other case, in the case of the glass transition I mentioned before, the T Tg, I didn't say it, but I suppose it was quite high. Now imagine that somehow I can cook up a system in which Tg is sufficiently low in such a way that quantum fluctuations start playing a role. So there are also interesting features that appear. There is quantum dynamics, so h bar is different from zero, I have quantum dynamics in them. And there's also something I'll discuss very, very briefly, which is important and quite different from the case of the classical problem, in the sense that for these quantum systems, the environment plays a special role and has non-trivial effects. So I'm putting all these systems together, and I'll try to discuss them more or less on the same at the same level, because we believe that one can imagine, I mean, one can start generating a generic theory or a generic theoretical approach, even if approximated, for all of them together. So let me start by proposing a certain family of models. These models have been proposed long ago, of course. Perhaps Derrida was the first to write this sort of Hamiltonian in the 80s. And these are models that are called p-spin models. So remember that at the beginning I said that I had in the glass problem a liquid or system of particles in interaction. Now, to simplify the theoretical approach, let's imagine that I have spins in interaction. Okay. Now, the Hamiltonian, the definition of the model is given by this Hamiltonian, where we have a set of interactions between p spins. So if p is equal to 2, we are used to this kind of interactions. It's a two-bud interaction. But if p is larger than 2, well, it's some sort of new kind of model. The spins, I can take them to be either easing or spherically constrained. So the sum over all the spins of Si squared is constrained to be the total number of spins, which is n. The interactions, I can take I can choose them to be quench random exchanges. By quench, I mean they don't evolve in time. Random because they are taken from a random probability distribution that one typically chooses to be a Gaussian distribution. And then there is a sum over the interactions over over groups of p spins that I'm indicating here. So I'll be more precise about how the sum over which values that the sum run a bit later. So this is this is the energy of my problem. Now let's imagine that I have to give it, I have to give some dynamics to the dynamic variables, the variables which are evolving, which are these spins. So let's propose that they evolve following a stochastic dynamics, a Langevin equation, where there is some thermal noise correlated in a white manner like this. And imagine that I also add external forces that might mimic the effect of the tapping, for instance, by being time dependent, like in the granular matter problem I mentioned in the first transparency. Or there can be non-potential forces so that they don't derive from a Hamiltonian to mimic the case of the shear rate in the rheological experiment, for example. So with this model and this sort of dynamics for the spins, I insist on the fact that the J's don't evolve in time. I claim that many of the properties of the glasses, the granular matter, and the rheology of complex liquids can be obtained. Of course, not all of them, but some of them at least. So up to here, everything I said is classical. The dynamics, I put it by hand to be stochastic because I say that my system is in contact with some thermal bath. If I want to describe instead a quantum problem, I cannot do this. I cannot write a Langevin equation like this. What I can do is, first of all, to quantify the model. So, for instance, by including something like a kinetic term like this, I could also go to true spins and put a transverse field. It doesn't matter so much. The only thing is that this term is non-commuting with the SIs in this case, so it's including quantum fluctuations. And if I want to describe a system that is not isolated completely, but is in contact with some environment, I can model this by including an interaction term between the system in which I'm interested in and some variables, some set of variables that describe the environment. So this axis here might describe harmonic oscillators, for instance, quantum harmonic oscillators. And I will have also a term that determines the evolution of these harmonic oscillators. And I will have a model of a system of spins, for instance, in contact with an environment made of oscillators. Of course, I can do different things, but this is the simplest one. So this is the simplest model I can cook up. So No, this is only for the classical case. For the quantum case, yes.
Scale
of field, soft spins, if you want to deal with Ising spins, or the spherical case, well, it's easy. You don't have to do anything special.
You're implicitly having soft spins.
Yes. In the classical case. In the quantum case, I do Schrödinger KLDs with this, and I derive macroscopic equations, for instance. Okay, so these are the kind of models that we have been looking at for many years now, and other people too, of course. So let me tell you what I'm doing with the interaction term. So there was a sum over spins, but I didn't say over which indices this sum was running. So the simplest case one can imagine is to consider a fully connected type of models in which all the spins interact with all the other ones. So if I say, what I mean by this is that in this sum, I'm summing over all the p-uplets I can construct in my system. So imagine the case of two pairwise interactions. I'm summing over all pairs of spins that there are in the system, and there is no information whatsoever about distance in the model. There's no geometry. It's a mean field model. So you would say, well, these models are very peculiar, and why are they going to be so interesting? Well, there are several reasons why they're interesting. The first one is that they are completely analytically solvable, both for their statics and their dynamics, and hence one can try and solve them and see if they have something to do, their behavior, with the behavior of real classes of the types I mentioned before. As I said, there are two families, if you wish. If I take the case P equals 2, and then I have pairwise interactions. This is the well-known Sherrington-Kilpatrick mean-field model for spin classes. But if I take P larger than 2, I have a different family. And actually, this happens to be the family that is that describes well, or at least describes in an approximate manner, but quite nicely, what's going on with structural glasses. And this was proposed by Kilpatrick, Thirumalai, and Wallinus also in the 80s. So the picture that comes out of the solution of these models is what has been called a discontinuous second order transition, or transitions, and I'll precise what I mean by this, also random first order scenario, and I think this is the name that Lutsenko gave for his talk. And the idea is the following. If you solve these problems analytically, what you find is that if you look at the behavior of the logarithm of the characteristic time for the relaxation as a function of temperature, you find that it increases fast and it diverges at some critical temperature that I'm calling TD. It really diverges here, so this is different from the picture I showed in the first transparency where I said that at TG the relaxation was increasing dramatically, but it was not diverging. It was just going up very, very fast at TG here. Here there is a true divergence. It's a power law divergence. This is different from what is observed experimentally, of course. But at least it captures this dramatic slowing down at a certain value of the critical temperature. And moreover, if you look at the statics of these problems, you would find that there is a true thermodynamic transition going on at some value that is usually called Ts that can be identified with the T naught I mentioned in the first transparency. So what these models are doing is that they're mimicking, in a mean field manner, this behavior that I mentioned at the beginning, and it's actually what is measured experimentally. Of course, they do this mimicking in an exaggerated manner because they have true phase transitions or true dynamic transitions where there are only crossovers or probably nothing in real systems, but, well, at least they have this nice feature. They have more things, more features that I'm going to describe later that have to do with the experimental observations, and one of these, which is the one I want to stress, is that below this TD, the models fall out of equilibrium. If you solve them in the limit of n thermodynamic limit going to infinity, what you find is that the models never manage to equilibrate below TD, and you have non-equilibrium dynamics with phenomena which are called aging that are also observed experimentally. So this is also nice. Now, what's the connection of all this, if there is any, with optimization problems. And I just flash one transparency to say that actually, if I look at these models, instead of in the fully connected limit, so say here I have p equals 2 with pairwise interactions where all spins, which are the dots here, interact with all others in the sample, I have a dilute problem in which each, say for instance, each spin interacts with only 2 in the sample. So imagine that the connectivity in this graph, which represents the interactions in the sample, is fixed to be c equals 2, for instance. Or if I do the p equals 3 case, I have to deal with a hypergraph. It's a little bit more difficult to draw, but it's the same idea. It happens that these p-spin models appear, and Andrea will explain this much better in his talk, are a representation of several very well-known optimization problems. So like, for instance, the codes that Andrea will describe, KSAT, they appear in a description of the case satisfiability problem, etc. So there are certain differences, like for instance, in the optimization problems, in principle, there is no temperature. The control parameter is another one, is some parameter that I call alpha, which is related to the concentration in the interactions. The problem one wants to solve is typically to find an optimal configuration that in physical terms corresponds to finding the global minimum of an energy functional that I can write in terms of spins and interactions, but of a dilute character now. And, okay, so one would like to know how to find this global minimum. One would like to know how many there are, etc. It's questions that have a translation in physical terms. And if one is interested in the dynamics, say, of the physical problem, in terms of the optimization problem, this means that one likes to know how algorithms, so the dynamics would be the algorithms that people are using to solve this problem, so to actually get the ground state or find the solution of the problem one is looking for. Now, of course, computer scientists are not constrained to use physical rules for the dynamics, so one can open the space of dynamics, consider much more general cases for the algorithms that one would use in a physical system. So there are interesting dynamic problems going on here, but of a much more general character, if you wish. Last thing I want to mention is that this structure of having two transitions, say, if alpha is my control parameter now, I could compare in principle with what I said about what happened with temperature in the glassy problem here. And typically in these sort of problems, what happens is that as a function of alpha, say, or 1 over alpha or some function of alpha, you have a phase where the problems are easy to solve. This would be like a liquid phase in the glassy problem. There is a region where you have a difficulty to find the solution, even if the solution probably exists, I mean, certainly exists, but the algorithms get stuck and they get slow dynamics and don't really find easily the solution that the problem has. So this would be what happens in the supercooled liquid phase, where the system actually does an equilibrium dynamics but is slow. And then you have a second transition where the optimization problems typically become non-solvable, and this could be associated to the glassy phase. So this is just to say that, well, there are deep connections between the kind of model I showed you before and problems in optimization, and in this case the connection is exact. Actually, the problems in optimization that one wants to solve are exactly mappable into these p-spin-like models. Yeah, okay. So in supercooled liquids, I'll show you now, maybe I can show you with this transparency. The dynamics is like an equilibrium, it's slow. The dynamics is slow, so typically the system doesn't relax exponentially. It relaxes with some power law, more complicated laws. But everything happens as in equilibrium. So it is a metastable state with respect to the crystal. The actual good configuration for the system is the crystal, if it exists. But the system doesn't get into the crystal. But all the relaxation happens as if the system were still in equilibrium in this higher free energy state. So by this I mean that if you look at correlation functions, they are stationary. They don't depend on the waiting time. When you start your measurement, they are stationary. Fluctuation dissipation theorem holds. One-time quantities don't depend on time. Things So if you look at the energy density, it converges.
Still cool.
Everything should give the same, exactly.
What's the difference between supercooled liquid and usually?
Only that the dynamics is slower.
Slower than
an exponential relaxation. So for instance, if you look at, for instance, imagine that they compute a correlation function that you like, that is meaningful for the system, density or something like this. So if you look at the relaxation of this quantity in the liquid phase, it would be an exponential decay. So very quick, nothing special. If you look at the relaxation of this quantity in the supercooled liquid phase, what you see, say that this blue curve here is taken for a given value of the temperature, so some value of the temperature, I get a structure like this. I get that the correlation approaches a plateau and then it goes down. This is a logarithm plot, for instance. So you see that this form is very different from an exponential relaxation. The dynamics is quite slow.
This is in the model.
No, this is in true life. This is an experiment. It's a sketch of an experiment. It's also in the model, but it's an extraction of.
So if I wait long enough, the supercooled fluid and normal fluid behave the same?
Not really, because if I do a normal liquid, if I plot the correlation function of a nice variable, so density correlation, what I get is that very quickly it goes to zero with some exponential function like this. Now, if I look at the same thing in the supercooled liquid phase, I will get something much slower, certainly not an exponential. And what I see is that if I plot it in log-log scale, I see that there is a plateau here developing. So for a high temperature, high but already in the supercooled liquid, so this is some T1 in the supercooled liquid, I get a structure with a plateau, a short plateau, and then it goes down. So this is non-exponential, certainly. Oh, here, very, very, very far away. Yes, probably it is. Yes, probably it is, yes.
I don't see any difference between.
If you look at very, very long time differences, you won't see it, but okay. In before arriving at those very, very long time differences, you see this structure. And this is observed. This is observed experimentally in a number of systems. Now, if you do the same measurement, but you choose a lower temperature, still in the supercooled liquid regime, you will find that the decay approaches the same plateau, and then it goes down, but later. If you go and approach, you know, take a longer time, a longer temperature, you do the measurement and you get that it goes down, but later. So there is a plateau that is developing here at a certain value, I'm calling it QD, and the way the correlation goes below this plateau gets slower and slower. I mean, when the correlation leaves this plateau, takes more and more time difference when the temperature goes down. So this is an experiment, say, in which I measure some correlation. This is somewhere. Here I'm plotting a phase diagram, imagine, where I have temperature. So this is in the classical glass, classical particle system where I can do experiments. Now, in the models, as I mentioned, I can do can also add quantum fluctuations. Imagine that I add an axis gamma, which has to do with the quantum fluctuations. So in the models, I get this sort of behavior anywhere close to this critical line, which is a true critical line in the model, I insist, but it's probably only a crossover in the system. I mean, certainly only a crossover in the system.
Are there experiments where it shows the plateau, then it shows the power, and then it shows the exponential? I mean, if you go just below.
Here, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, you just.
No, people insist that here, mostly they see stretch exponentials.
But if you go long,
but
enough,
if you go long enough, you will get an exponential. So.
Are there experiments where you can see all three?
I think so, yeah.
In fact, if you look at the self-intermediate scattering in the system, you have to get exponential at long time to get
yes.
diffusion in the system. And you can see this, I think, at intermediate temperatures. You can see all, yeah. you know, non-power law, different power law, stretched exponential, and then exponential.
Yeah. Okay, so. So this sort of behavior is captured by the models I mentioned before, and actually this is one of the great successes of these models, and also of mode capping theory, which is related to these models in the supercooled liquid phase. So the fact that there is this two-step relaxation is one of the big successes of this approach that people have used in the liquid community for many years now. Now, I can do the same or a similar procedure, and instead of looking at the decay of a correlation function, look at what happens with a response function. So this guy here is the response to applying some field, for instance, at a certain time, and looking at how the response to this field grows with the time difference. So this T here is the same as this one, is what happens after having perturbed the system in this case and after not doing anything to the system in this case. I mean the reference for the measurement of the correlation in this case. So what happens is basically that this curve gets inverted. And one sees that the way in which the response grows with time depends on temperature. So this is higher temperature, this is still lower, this is slightly lower, and so on. And what happens in the models is that the length of this plateau, or the length of this plateau, diverges when approaching the critical line. That diverges as the power law I mentioned before, T minus TD to some minus some power. I insist, in real systems, probably this is not completely true, but there is no true transition line at gamma at TD. But OK, it's an approximation. Now, if I had quantum fluctuations, what I would see here are some oscillations at short time differences, but I won't see anything special, any special difference for longer time differences, at least in the models. This is what is found in the models. Now, just one last thing about this. The fact that this QD here is finite, the fact that there is a plateau here, is interpreted like another parameter. It will be something like plays the role of another parameter at lower temperatures. And the fact that QD is non-zero, that there is a plateau at the finite value, is what is related to the discontinuous character of this transition, which otherwise is second order thermodynamically, because nothing happens to the thermodynamic potentials in the models at TD. Now, I wanted to say a couple of words about quantum problems. Just one thing. Yes.
You develop a circuitry minimum, never stable minimum, density functional.
I'm sorry.
It is. In density functional, you develop a circuitry metastable minimum at that time, you know, at that temperature. This mode coupling transition temperature, there is also a static transition temperature.
No, but the static transition temperature is somewhere else. It's a low, it's a lower value TS, which is different from TD. Here I'm saying what's going on at TD. At TD, there is no divergence of a thermodynamic potential. It's not a true, it's not a first order thermodynamic transition. It's second order thermodynamically, if you wish. I mean, there's nothing.
Dynamically. I'm referring to density functional theory from seeing Stosan Wallis, where they calculated the energy of the function of localization parameter. So a TA, that's essentially TA we're talking about, this is TD, right? There's a secondary metastable minimum appearing on the free energy curve.
But the only thing I mean is that if you look at, you know, susceptibilities or whatever you want to look at, there is nothing jumping. Okay, so what's the effect? If I look at the quantum problem, I have to couple it to an environment, I said, to make it relax. And so just one word about it, which is quite amusing, I find, is the fact that if you couple it to an environment, what you find is that the position of this dynamic critical line changes with the coupling to the environment. So if I consider the system coupled to, say, a bath of quantum oscillators, and the strength of this coupling is given by some value, I get this curve. So this is in the limit of the coupling going to zero. And now if I increase the strength of the coupling to the environment, I get a different transition line that increases with the strength of the coupling to the environment. So it's quite amusing the fact that if I use, say, I look at the dynamics at one point here, with one kind of environment, I find it to be in the liquid phase, and with another one, I find it to be in the glassy non-equilibrium relaxation regime. So I think this is quite nice. This is similar to the effect. that's similar to the localization effects in a two-well potential when you couple it to an environment of oscillators, and then you can produce localization. It's similar in the sense that you have to identify the localized phase as the glassy phase. But in two words, it's like this. Okay, so what happens below this critical line TD or in the glassy regime? What happens is, I said that the system doesn't manage to equilibrate anymore with this environment, so there are non-equilibrium effects that appear. And what are these non-equilibrium effects? They go under the name of aging. We heard a lot about them in the workshop. And what this means simply is that the relaxation now not only depends on temperature or gamma if you are in the quantum problem, but it also depends on when you start your measurement. It depends on how much time has been spent by the system after preparation. So what I mean by this is that imagine that you prepare your system and you call the time when you prepare your system by getting inside this regime zero, time zero. Now you let your system wait a certain TW without doing anything to it, and next you look at this configuration, you let your system evolve, and you compute the correlation function between the configuration at TW and at the next time TW plus T. So if I look at the correlations now, how they decay in time, as a function of this extra time T, I find that they also depend on TW here. So the blue curve corresponds to a short TW, the red curve corresponds to a longer TW, the yellow curve to a still longer TW, and so on. And this doesn't stop. In the models, it doesn't stop. In a real system, the real system is finite in size, it will eventually stop. But this would happen after, for longer times than the ones I can reach experimentally. So in practice, this is a thing that is observed experimentally. With the integrated linear response, it's the same thing. There is a first increase, and then a next increase toward a different value that depends on TW. I mean, the way in which the integrated responses grow depend on the waiting time expend after entering the glassy phase. So I can define a characteristic time, if you wish, by how this curve decreases from the plateau, and I notice that this characteristic time depends on TW. The way in which it depends might be non-trivial, it might be a power law, it might be something else, this will depend on the sample and so on. In the case of these models, it's rather easy, but real systems can be more complicated, law. So what has to be stressed here is that we still have a two-step relaxation with the first approach to a plateau. You notice that this first approach to the plateau, I would draw all the curves together, so there is no explicit waiting time dependence while the correlations approach the plateau. It's only later that they decay below the plateau and where I see the explicit waiting time dependence and the explicit aging effects, if you wish. Another thing I can say is that the decay here, I draw this in logarithm scale, so the decay below the plateau is very slow. It's certainly not exponential, it's something like power law, or this again will depend on the system. While the first part of the decay here is faster in this growing. If I had quantum fluctuations, I would see, again, oscillations here, but I don't see anything special going there. The curves don't change qualitatively. So these are the main features I wanted to show. Let me just flash one experimental curve to convince you that these things exist in real life. So this is an experiment of a colloidal suspension. And this is the measurement of a relevant correlation function for this system. This is light scattering measurements. And this is the extra time t. And these different curves correspond to different waiting times. And you see clearly that there is a plateau here and then the decay from the plateau. And there is a characteristic time for relaxation that has been drawn as a function of TW in the inset. These systems are nice, and you'll hear more about them from Luca Cipelletti, in the sense that they can also be looked at them experimentally. They're systems of particles floating on some fluid, and you can follow the traces of the particles, and here you have a very natural and very nice interpretation of why these curves look like this. If you look at what happens with the trajectory of a particle at short time differences, you see that it rattles within a cage, made by the other particles. Of course, this is full of particles, so it is like if the particle was moving very fast for short-time differences, and only then it moves to somewhere else in the system. So this part here represents the large rearrangements of the sample where particles really move far away. Well, this part here of the relaxation is simply like each particle oscillating, if you wish, within a cage made of the other ones. You would see the same sort of behavior if you do a rheological measurement, and then you plot the curves. By doing rheology, by moving the system with an external force, what you do is to manage to stationarize the relaxation. There is no more weight in time dependence, but actually there are curves very similar to this that depend on the shear rate, and the stronger the shear rate, the faster the decay of the samples. This is something that has also been can also be obtained from these models. Okay, so you heard about effective temperatures this morning. I want to make some points a bit more precise, or be a bit more explicit about those things now. Actually, in an out-of-equilibrium system, there is no reason why the fluctuation-dissipation relation that tells me how responses are related to correlations, why this relation should hold. It doesn't need to hold out-of-equilibrium. And if you go and look and compare for these models, P-spin-like models, for instance, what happens with the integrated response corresponding to this experiment where I prepare my system at time zero, I apply a field at Tw, and I look at the integrated response between Tw and T plus Tw, this guy here, this is like a susceptibility, I can compare it to the behavior of the correlation between these two, Tw and T. So what I'm doing is simply, I'm doing a parametric plot, I will do a parametric plot between these two curves here. So I choose a Tw, I choose the blue curve and the blue curve, and I plot one point here against one point here for the same value t. So for instance, here t is equal to 0, k is equal to 0, and c is equal to 1. So I get one point in my parametric plot that is this one, okay, or this one here. I let t evolve, I get another point here, and I put another point here or another point here, and so on. So if I do this parametric construction for increasing waiting times, let me do it first in equilibrium. In equilibrium, above Td, what happens is that for a very short waiting time, okay, I get a curve which doesn't mean anything special. If I choose a sufficiently long waiting time, I typically go beyond the equilibration time of the sample, which is quite short. And what I get with this construction is just a straight line with slope minus 1, the temperature of the bath with which I'm in contact. This is the classical case, so I have a bath, I get minus 1 over the temperature of the bath. Now, if I do the same construction in the model below Td, what I find is that this procedure for longer waiting times approaches an asymptotic form, and this asymptotic form is just a broken straight line. So there's a first piece which has the slope of the temperature of the bath, and there is a second piece which has a different slope. This is the solution to these models, and it's exact. You would say, okay, these models, I don't know if they are so realistic. One can go and check if this same behavior appears in more realistic systems, and I will show you some results, numerical results, in a second. But before doing that, what I want to say is that, of course, by looking at this plot, one is tempted to say that if this slope here is given by minus 1, the temperature of the bath, I would like to call this slope here minus 1 over some effective temperature. But of course, before doing that, one has to prove that this quantity really behaves as a temperature. I could call it temperature, but I could call it something else. So if I want to call it a temperature, I have to be sure that this thing has the properties of a temperature. And this is something that we have done with Jorge and Luca Pelliti some years ago. I won't give many details about this, but let me give you one detail, which is the fact that we show that this quantity, this second slope, and if I have many of these slopes, each of them, can be measured by a thermometer. So it's something that has to do with the temperature, in the sense that if I look at what is a thermometer, what does a thermometer do if I couple to this system. So this is a glassy system. I make image copies of these to do a statistical measurement and a couple of thermometers to those. I look at what happens with the evolution of the thermometer, and I find that the evolution of the thermometer, for instance, the energy of the thermometer, is given by a ratio which is exactly given by these slopes. So what I mean by this is that if I choose a thermometer such that its internal frequency is very high, it will react to the, in the case of the particle glass I showed before, the rapid motion of the particles that are rattling within the cages, and I will see these dynamics of the system, and I see that the thermometer gets charged by T. So this ratio is equal to T, the temperature of the bath, and I don't see anything surprising. But if I choose a thermometer that is able to react to the slow motion in the sample, what I get is this second slope here, which is the second value, or the second value, yes, that the FDT ratio is taken in the model. So this can be proven beyond using mean field models, actually. We have done it in general. The only thing that has to be used is that there is a well separation of timescales between the rapid motion and the slow motion. But this is something that is, at least in certain samples, observed, like, for instance, the experimental curve I showed before. Well, exactly. This is another thing. I was not going to discuss it, but if this has a meaning, it has to be independent of the observable A, because I cannot have different temperatures associated to different observables. It would be meaningless. So this is one of the other things that we have checked analytically. I can show you some numerical curves that test this idea. This is, again, a shear Leonard-Jones, like the same sample that Langer showed this morning. And these are these chi, again, C plots for these Leonard-Jones particle systems. And you see these are different observables. So these are different K wave values for the correlation CK and the response CK. This is the parametric plot. So say for 1K, you get this red curve here. For this green, this is a different K that corresponds to this other curve over here, and so on. So what you see is that this straight line here is given by the inverse of the temperature of the bath. They all share the connection to the bath, let's say. So they all have the same 1 over T, the temperature of the bath slope here. And they all have the same slope after the breaking point. So this is telling us that this definition is consistent in the sense that different observables have the same slope. Note that if I were doing the total chi against the, say, if I were doing the slope between this point and this point, so if I were doing the average slope here, I could get a different result for the different curves. This is to stress the fact that it's very important to look at this quantity, looking at different timescales, and separating what's going on in this timescale from what's going on in that one, not mixing them by integration. Another point I want to stress is that if I mentioned that this effective temperature can be measured with a thermometer, a way to do this experiment is to put a tracer. So you put a different particle within the sample and you follow its evolution. And when you follow its evolution, you can look at what happens with the kinetic energy of this external particle I'm putting in the sample as a function of the mass, for instance, of the particle. So this mass is playing the role of the frequency of the thermometer that I mentioned in the previous transparency, and this is the energy of my external particle. So what these people, Berthier and Barra, observed is that, as expected, the value that you get for this kinetic energy as a function of the mass moves from the temperature of the bath for low values of the mass, for low temperatures of the external mass towards a different value here. And this different value here is exactly the slope that you get from here. So you see that this is consistent. I'm measuring a temperature with a thermometer here, and it's the same value that I got from the FDT measurements over there. One can do other checks with different observables and things that I'm not going to measure. So this can be put in contact with the structure of the energy landscape for these models and do things about measures and so on, but I'm not going to discuss those. What I'm going to do very quickly is to say something about fluctuations. Everything I said up till now was a mixture between some experimental results, some numerics, but analytically or from modeling, the only thing I discussed were these mean field models that I said were very useful in many respects. But of course, in real systems, when it's in finite dimensions, and we would like to say something about what happens, for instance, with the fluctuations within the samples and things that are related to what is called in the GLASI community dynamic spatial heterogeneity, so I would put it this way. So it's a problem that is calling the attention of many people now. So I'll be a little bit technical now in this transparency and I'll stop in the next one. The idea is the following. What we're trying to do is to say something about fluctuations. So the first thing we know is that, actually from the work of Sompolinski in the 80s, is that if one looks at the dynamic equations for these fully connected models, like the P-spin model, you can write down exact dynamic equations for the correlations and the responses, and one can see from its structure that they acquire an approximate time reparametrization invariance in the limit of long times. So what I mean by this is that if I look at these equations when, say, the shortest time, say T2, is very, very long, what I find is that there are terms that vanish because I know they're going to become very small. But, and then once these terms have been thrown away, the remaining equations are invariant under the change of time, both times, into any function of the same times. So what I'm doing is I'm changing T1 into an H of T1, T2 into the same H of T2, and I'm claiming that the correlations and the response don't change under this transformation. So in the regime of T2 being very long, I insist, and looking at the equations for the slow part of the relaxation, where there are the actual aging effects, the explicit dependence on T weighting, as I said, then the equations become approximately invariant under this very large transformation. Now, this is a fact. What can we say in finite dimensional systems? We cannot prove nothing like this, but we can argue things related to this. So what we have argued is that if I write an action for the slow decay, so I have an action for the full dynamics of my system, a finite D spin glass, for instance, and now what I can argue is that if I integrate away the terms that depend on the fast part of the motion, I get an effective action for the slow decay of now space-dependent correlations and responses. So R here is a site on the system, and C underscore R is a coarse-grained quantity around the chosen site on the system. What we have argued is that this effective action is also invariant under this global transformation. So what I'm doing is I'm changing all times into the same function of the same times independently of the site R. So I'm changing all the sites in the same manner. I insist, this is not a rigorous proof, it's an argument. Now, once I have done this, and I accept this result, what I can do is do some predictions or propose some behaviors starting from this point. And the idea is that if I have that the slow part of the decay of the global correlation, where I'm averaging over all the system, so this is the whole system, the decay of the whole system, imagine that it decays in this way. So imagine that the correlation functions I showed here. So imagine that in this part of the decay, which is the slow part of the decay, the correlations scale like this function here. So it's a function of some chosen function h tilde over the same function h tilde evaluated on the two times, T2 and T1. So this could be a power law, for instance. If in my system scales like an f of T2 over T1, then I'm proposing that locally the fluctuations will be such that this external function f doesn't change, while this internal function h does depend on the site. And why I am saying so? Because I'm saying that the effective action has an invariance, so there is a soft mode associated to these transformations, and then I argue that it will be very easy to change, or rather easy, say, to change this function h from side to side, but it won't be easy to change this one outside. This is like making an argument like in a continuous ferromagnet sort of XY model or Heisenberg model, where this time reparametrization invariance plays the roles of rotations, and this plays the role of this will play the role of spin waves in the system. So, to finish. Why, sorry?
What is the physical argument that requires a symmetric equation?
That the dynamics get slower and slower as time goes on. This is a fact. In a sense, yes. What happens is that when you look at the action that you have terms which depend on time derivatives, and these become less and less important as time increases. Because when I look at the dynamics of, you know, the decay of the correlations, I notice that the decay is slower and slower as the time separation increases and as the total time increases too. So these terms become less and less important, if you wish. And if I drop them, and if I drop everything that has to do with these terms, the invariance is exact. I know this is not completely true. I know that these terms have an effect, and the effect is to choose, actually, this function h tilde. The effect of these terms is to select, this is like a little pinning field, if you wish, only that this pinning field is decreasing in time. And it's a bit more complicated than that because there are two times that are playing a role. It is. This thing is the fact that the correlation is scaled this way can be argued on different, on different grounds. It's the fact that this scale like this has to do with the properties of two-time correlations in general. I mean, it's not an approximation in the slow regime. What is an approximation is that this effective action will become invariant under reparametrizations of time. Okay, I'll just one plot. From this argument, one can do certain predictions. I will simply show one because it's probably the one that it's related to Lucas' talk, and I want to discuss this with him later. So just to motivate him, I don't know where he is. So the idea is that once we have argued this, one can go further and say that if I'm going to propose that the local correlations scale like this, but with an h here that depends on the site, I can do a little transformation and put the dependence on the site in an exponential. It's simply easier from the technical point of view. And then what you can do is, based on the symmetry that I want to have in my effective action, propose an action for these variables here. So this is a little bit technical, we can discuss it later, but the point is that once one has proposed a certain action for these variables phi r, one can extract from this action, this is the one we have, it's a proposal, from this action you can extract, for instance, the distribution of the correlation functions. So I can extract the form of how the local correlation functions are going to be distributed from site to site. So what I mean by this is I choose the two times, T2 and T1, and look at what's the value of the local correlation between these two times on each side of my sample, coarse-grained, and I trace the distribution. Well, I get a certain form. These are simulations, the points, and the curve is some fitting curve to these dots. It happens to be some modified Gumbel distribution. And what I claim is that from these kind of arguments, one can extract the form of the distributions of the local correlations and compare to either experiments, these are Lukacs-Belletti's experiments, or numerical simulations, or other sorts of measurements. Maybe there are no other kind of measurement. So this could be a way of, you know, interacting with experimentalists and numerical people to try to see which is the effective action for the slow part of the relaxation of these glassy systems. So. Yes, I finished by flashing the. Yeah. No. Tell me.
To predict this row of C, you have to know the function f.
Yes. But the function f is given by the global, by the decay of the global correlation. I claim that the function f is fixed by the decay of the global correlation. So in a measurement, I can do the global measurement. I extract the form of the function f, and then I plug it into my prediction for the distribution, and I see if it's consistent or not. So this is could be the closing the loop. So to finish, summary and conclusions, I simply want to say that, okay, there is a consistent mean field theory, which is based on these p-spin models, and so on, to describe the glass transition. It's not a real transition, but what's going on around TG, and the glassy dynamics below. There are many features that can be described with these sort of theories. I won't discuss them, I haven't discussed them all, but just some of them. The interesting thing about these models is that they predict new features that were difficult to guess, actually, or haven't been guessed before from other approaches, like these modifications of FDT, relations to effective temperatures, and so on. Now, the challenge is to be able to go beyond mean field, either do corrections for finite n to the fully connected models I discussed, or to try to argue something about finite dimensions. And the things I discussed by the end were the routes we are following with Claudio Chamon and other people, which are based on using this time reparametrization invariance as a guiding symmetry to construct a sort of sigma modal approach to the slow dynamics of glasses. So, thank you. Yes.
Can you put the slide?
Which one? This one?
No, the data.
Oh, sorry, the data. This one here.
So is there a feature for the validity of the hypothesis of Tenenbaum?
No, it's not a check. What you can do to check are other sort of measurements, we can discuss them later on. But what I claimed here only is that, for instance, experimentally, people have observed a strange distribution of correlation functions like this. We are trying to go in that direction, but for the moment, we haven't really done it in detail. But of course, I'm not sure for the moment, but what we are aiming at with Claudio is to try to say something like 3D should be different from 2D, because in general people don't expect to find a transition in 2D. Can this be related somehow to multifractality and things like this? But I don't know, I mean, but of course it's...
So the results for the violation of the fluctuation dissipation theorem, in general, if you look at the correlation and the response, the ratio of the time derivative of the correlation to the response
yes.
should only be necessarily, in the most general sense, related to the correlation function itself. It need not be a constant.
Yes.
Right? Are there any systems where you don't find an effect, you know, simple effective temperature?
Yes. For instance, in the sheared case, if you shear it like math, you will get a relation which is
experimental. So just on the computer. Then.
Well, experimentally, there haven't been so many experiments checking the FDT violation.
The rates are ridiculously high, right? Are they extremely?
You mean in the numerical calculations?
No. They're, to get to that regime where you would see this kind of, you would have to really shear the system very rigorously.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know how to put it in real, in terms of real quantities, you know, comparable to experiments. But in the simulations, they are reachable easily. If you shear it very quickly, it's clear that, you know, you don't have any more slow dynamics. The system is moving like crazy. So in that regime, it's clear that you wouldn't expect nothing like that. Or in the tapped granular matter, if you put it in the glass, in the gas regime, you wouldn't have anything. So
always about this rho of C.
Yeah.
Here you expanded the action to the Gaussian order, so I don't understand how you can get something which is not Gaussian for C.
No, because actually, you know, for instance, you get these sort of things even for Gaussian actions if the observable you're looking at is a nonlinear function of the variable that is Gaussian distributed.
Yeah, but
so you see the phi r here, I agree, it's a Gaussian thing, but the C I'm looking at is a complicated function of the Gaussian variable. Yes, over space, if you wish. But this has been observed, for instance, the XY model, the fluctuations of the magnetization in the XY model, you have an action which looks very much like this, but the magnetization is a nonlinear function of the phase, and then you get a non-trivial distribution of the magnetization.
Yeah,
You mentioned that your temperature T sub D is somehow similar to what Langer discussed this morning, the temperature which you said you can measure with the thermometer.
Right, yes.
So as far as I understood, Langer's temperature, its main feature was that energy dissipation was going to increase that temperature.
Yes.
This property?
Yes. Yes. Of course. Yes. This we checked in '97 with Jorge. Yeah. Yeah. This temperature is controlling the flow of heat, and if you, for instance, put two systems in contact, imagine that you construct two glasses. You construct them to be such that they have different temperatures, different values of this effective temperature. Now imagine that you are able to put them in contact and to make them interact. Then you do the measurement and you observe that these two values become the same. So by, if the interaction is strong enough and you make them interact, the observers, they get the same value. Yes, sure.
I'd like to ask a question. I believe that the gas transition has somehow to do with sphere relaxation. Like the experimentalists argue that the gas transition happens when the viscosity is above a certain value. And
yeah.
Also, I think from a theoretical point of view, it's intriguing to see how viscous fluid can via continuous transition turn into something which has a rigidity for shear. And somehow there doesn't seem to be room for this kind of, which I think is essential for it.
I agree perfectly well, but... yeah, it...
I'm fine with that, but this we have seen in the spin glass.
If you use gel cutting, for example, and try to pour it, it'll look like you're pouring water from a glass. You won't see, there's just a matter of length scale, time scale. Viscously, it looks just like regularly if you work with a large enough length and time scale.
No, so you agree with that. But
with that kind of glass we have in the window, we...
It's very viscous.
Okay, but on the time scale we are looking at it, it seems to be elastic, right? I mean, people who work with glasses certainly treat them as elastic as a proper solid, right?
But his point is that if you take a dive off a 50-foot bridge, you're going to think the water beneath you is elastic too. And
I think this is the mass effect of water. I thought it was correct. I think it's because water has mass. That's the thing. It's molasses or honey is a good example. If you change your mind, it's a good drink. If you change your mind and you put back your bottle, the drink won't go back into the bottle, right?
No, but this is not the question.
No, this is not the question.
It's sheer. It's not a relaxation of density fluctuation I'm after. I completely agree.
Okay, if you shear your glass very slowly, it will yield. That's what I'm saying. So if you're willing to wait, you put your finger on a glass and wait for, 10 or something years, you'll see your fingerprint.
I guess we should consider.
Yes, I think you had a question, right?
Yeah. There was one more question.
Yeah. Do you have any prediction about how that rho function would change as you change the difference between P1 and P2?
Right, we are working on that. Actually, I didn't say it explicitly, but you see this gamma here. I call it a stiffness, and it's related to this external function F that appears in the global correlation. And in principle, from here, that if I would be more precise, should be something within this Gaussian action here, I should be able to say something about how this function will change with times and with the ratio between the two times, and see how it approaches a Gaussian distribution like the one you had. So we are working on that, but haven't had results yet. Yeah.
Okay.
Jorge?
If possible, let's continue later because we are already running late. So let's thank our speakers. Our next